Hello and welcome to The Media Show. I'm Brenda Power, and in this edition, digital champion David Putnam on his mission for Ireland.
I see it as a catalyst, really, for change. I'd have no power, so all I have is the power to catalyse.
While laptops are beating the box in the corner...
If I want to see any of the shows that I'm interested in, I kind of do need to watch it online.
And TV3 boss Jeff Ford on whether he will challenge The Late Late Show.
That's probably an ambition of everyone, because it's such a staple of the Irish broadcast landscape.
But first... The sounds there of Monday's Boston Marathon bombing. David Abel, who was covering the event for the Boston Globe, was one of many reporters who captured the whole thing online.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Indeed, news of the bombing first broke on social media, with runners and spectators tweeting images and reports from the scene. Now, part of the challenge for news media covering the event was to sift the truth from the panic and the rumours. Storyful is an online news platform, and Malachy Brown, news editor of Storyful, joins me now. So, Malachy, this was a big night on Twitter, the good and the bad. How did you sort what was true from what was false?
Really what we're looking at is authenticated sources on the ground. There are really valuable tools like Eyewitness, Adaptive Path, Geofedia. And what these do is they gather geolocated tweets. So we were able to hone in on Copley Square and look at the people who were reporting from the scene and choose those people who were reporting facts and sharing photos and group those together into a list also as citizen reporters who appeared to be reputable. Making a list and combining that with official sources, you had a really good picture of what was happening from moment to moment.
Now, I know there were lots of people unwittingly maybe retweeting information and speculation that maybe was unfounded. Was this a situation where old-fashioned news values came to the fore as well?
Absolutely. It's about asking questions about every piece of information. I mean, for us as a newsroom monitoring it remotely, we had a bigger picture. We were monitoring WBZ TV, a live stream from them. We were monitoring the police scanner. And we could see people on Twitter reporting speculation based on information that was being shared on the police scanner. Police were examining bags, but people were misreporting that as there are multiple devices. So, you know, applying scrutiny to every piece of information that crosses your radar is essential.
But the Boston Globe, I believe, was also up to speed.
The Boston Globe were. They have their own contacts and local journalists on the ground with such contacts are invaluable.
Would you say this was one of those stories that just reaffirms the fact that, or at least I suppose would suggest, that citizen journalism will never actually replace professional, old-fashioned, well-sourced reporting?
No, it won't. Social media has to be viewed through the prism of traditional journalistic values. What social media is a great tip line. It's like a phone line to any newsroom, except there are far more sources and each of these have to be vetted. It's possible to put a lot of work in prior to events happening to organise these sources in a systematic way and authenticating certain sources. But no, validation is absolutely key.
On your own blog, I know, Malachy, you had a fantastic narrative in which you traced a video made by the daughter of a woman who was running. Just tell me how that came about.
As soon as we got news of the explosions in Boston, we were using search terms for the street names for Boston itself through social media platforms to bring that story to visual. What I mean by that is to get photos and videos that people were uploading from the scene. This photo was taken from a runner's perspective. She had a GoPro camera on her head as she was running towards the finish line as the bomb exploded. We found that video on an obscure YouTube account. In short, we managed to trace that username through various social media platforms to identify a teenager in New York. Now, the next step is to identify that this teenager in New York is connected with the runner in Boston. The teenager's surname was Tracy. By simply looking at the registrants for the marathon, we found one hit as Jennifer Tracy from New York, and we were able to find her phone number and speak to her about the video, and she gave us additional context about her experience.
And I believe the Boston police used social media very effectively in the immediate aftermath of the bombing.
Yes, the Boston police were very quick at sending out essential information. They were very low volume, but nuggets of what was happening and what their officers were doing. It was on the Boston police account and also on the public information officer account. So, for instance, when a fire was reported at the JFK library in Boston, Of course, speculation mounted that this too was connected to the bombings. In fact, it wasn't. It was a mechanical failure. And the police were very quick to say, we're treating it as connected, but we have no confirmation that it is so at the moment. Similarly, when people misreported the police scanner that there were multiple devices, the police were very quick on Twitter to say, no, we don't have any evidence that there are multiple devices here. And so, in effect, they were downplaying the panic that was spreading through social media and to people on the ground.
Malachy Brown of Storyful there. Well, that's the unmistakable theme from Chariots of Fire, and its 10-time Oscar-winning producer, David Putnam, who now lives in Skibbereen, has been named as Ireland's digital champion. I caught up with him last Monday at the Institute of International and European Affairs in Dublin, just ahead of his speech on Ireland's digital future, and I asked him about his new role and what he's going to do.
I see it as a kind of a catalyst, really, for change. I'd have no power, so all I have is the power to catalyse. I work for two ministers, Rory Quinn and Pat Rabbit, who I like a lot, both of whom are genuine enthusiasts and have given me a great deal of freedom. The really important thing is to make sure that as the digital world develops, it does not develop in silos, that it escapes from the not invented here world that certainly has bedeviled me for many, many, many years working in the UK, and is seen as running right across society. So bringing people together is going to be far and away the most important part of the job, and getting people to understand that this is about infrastructure, it's about education, it's about the elderly, you know, it's about loneliness, it's about addressing the problems that Ireland has as a very largely rural community, Asian communities. I mean, it's about all those things, getting them to talk to each other, getting them to share experiences, and getting to see how they can be of mutual assistance to each other. I think it's a pretty big job. If I do that, I'll have done a great job.
Creativity is at the heart of your thinking about digital media. Tell me, everybody these days is a producer, a creator, can make music online. How does the industry compete with that, if you like? How do you add value?
I'm very, very keen that the richness of the web and the richness of the digital society is used to get engaged in informed debates, for example, on things like climate change. Climate change is immensely complicated. It will affect the lives of all my children, certainly all my grandchildren. That deserves a richness of debate, not a simplification of debate. It has to start with the producers because the consumers, in the end, respond to what the producers do. I was a film producer. It was my responsibility to offer my audience something that elevated them and allowed them to walk out of the cinema feeling better about themselves, more informed about the world, and with some kind of ideas running around their head. I used to think the great triumph for a movie producer was, what was the conversation going to be over coffee after the movie? Had you created a more elevated conversation and a more interesting conversation and a more informed conversation, you know, coming out of the killing fields? Did you know more about Cambodia, and did you want to know more about Cambodia? I'd like to think you did. I could have just made a Sylvester Stallone slam bang shoot 'em up movie. I didn't, because that's not the way I want society to evolve.
And Ireland's had a slow start, as you know, due to the slow rollout of broadband. What's your vision for the future here?
I think we've got to speed up adoption. There is a long tail of non-adopters that need to understand the way in which their lives can be richer and benefit from digital adoption. I think that we need to sort our thinking out regarding intellectual property and the ownership of intellectual property and the use of intellectual property. I would very much like Ireland to take the lead in Europe over inducing probably the right word because it's nice and neutral, the ISPs to begin to understand that they have responsibility, that they are not just pipes, tubes and conveyors of information. They actually have responsibilities, and have them play a more significant, important and active role in the way in which the digital society that we live within develops. It's not the same as just a line or a connecting device. It actually has to make some judgments. And those judgments, if they're made correctly, actually could both stimulate the economy and actually make this a more harmonious and a more comfortable society to live in. Ireland's one of the most articulate countries, I think, in the world. The Irish don't even realise how articulate they are. They're good at formulating ideas, and they're good at explaining and communicating those ideas. And that's going to be a fundamental skill in the digital world. We're going to have to escape from the duh-like, you know, form of society into something a lot more articulate. There are reasons for that. Some of them are technological. And Ireland's beautifully placed to be, as it were, or could almost be the world's explainer, the world's conduit of interesting information, and maybe even the word synthesizer of interesting information.
Now, you've been very passionate about the Leveson inquiry and the criticism for news media and journalism. What's your view of the Royal Charter, the outcome of Leveson?
I don't like the idea of Royal Charter being used as a way of avoiding parliamentary debate, which is actually what's happened. Having said that, I think the outcome from my perspective is probably as good as was available at the moment. And I think it's an interesting precursor to a much bigger debate that's got to take place, which is the whole issue of ownership and plurality and concentration of power in the media. So for me, as a staging post, I think the Royal Charter and getting a debate going and then rolling forward is valuable. There's no question about that. I think that it's been a huge reality check, or should have been a huge reality check, on the press media, and a place to move on from. We're still getting the threat that some of the press barons won't sign up to it. I think they'd be crazy, because the alternative to signing up to it is you're going to have a series of very high-profile lawsuits. And the notion that the media would wish to find themselves in the hands of judges making judgments, which you can never know which way those are going to bounce, would seem to be crazy. So I don't actually think, I think I'm listening to all the threats and the huffing and puffing, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of foot dragging. But in the end, I think the Royal Charter will get signed up to. And I think that far from inhibiting the press, I think there'll be a huge sigh of relief. I talked to a lot of journalists. Within the journalistic world, I think there'll be a big sigh of relief. So I see a drift towards journalists having being more empowered, having more say in the nature of what they do. And yeah, I think there's going to be some of the old-time editors who are going to hate it, but they're just going to have to, as my wife always says, suck it up and get on with it.
Lord Putnam, Ireland's digital champion there. Now, this week, RTE launched a new multi-platform channel, RTE Junior, for children up to 7 years. It's commercial-free and it brings together radio, television and online content. A welcome initiative for a young audience, but in our Media Watch column today, Sheena Horgan makes a case for more.
We live in a media-saturated society. There are hundreds of TV channels, loads of magazines, and endless mobile and digital options. So today's children's media landscape is as vast as it is varied, and they embrace it with vigour. Which begs the question, is all this media consumption good for our children? Irish children's TV consumption is higher than the rest of Europe, up to 3 hours a day. And there's an opportunity cost with that, because if they're watching TV, they're not doing other stuff like playing with other kids and being active and outdoors. And if they consume that amount of TV, that means they see up to 30 ads a day. And watersheds are pointless, as the second highest viewing time for Irish children is 9 p.m. to midnight. In addition, Irish children watch many TV programmes that were not designed with them specifically in mind. Think of Corrie and Vare City and EastEnders. The media content our children consume plays a clear role in helping shape their view of the world, and indeed of themselves. What they access will have an impact on them. And in the absence of guidance or alternative information, this content will be seen as the norm. Self-regulation and legislation around TV advertising is flawed because only a third of the TV Irish children watch is Indigenous. But there is one obvious route to responsible and safe media consumption for children, and that's to empower them, to help them to choose, use and view media, all media, with a critically curious eye. A media literacy programme in schools could redress children's vulnerability through education. As well as protecting them, it will give them a valuable life skill that will stand to them as they grow up. So the young empowered consumers of today can be the savvy media consumers of tomorrow.
And that's journalist and author Sheena Horgan. And if you'd like to have your say, contact me on mediashow@rte.ie. Well, time was when watching television involved a remote control, a sofa and a TV schedule. But today more and more of us are watching television online, on smartphones, on players and catch-up channels. Some of us even watching shows like The Late Late Show on The Box while chatting about it on Facebook and Twitter at the same time. I'm joined by Laura Slattery of the Irish Times to talk about what's changing for television. But first, Caitney Clary has been talking to some under 25-year-olds about their viewing habits.
I use RT Player because I always miss Love Hate when it's on and I always have to watch it back. And the same with Republic of Telly as well.
Sky Go is very good. You know, you can watch on demand what was on your Sky TV.
Whenever I come home and I go into the TV room, my dad's always in there hogging the TV and he's got several things recording. Whenever I do want to watch one of my shows, my parents just usually think it's brain dead and they cause like an argument over it.
Mostly I just watch TV with a laptop on, because if you're watching it on a laptop, that's all your laptop is doing. You can't be on Facebook and watching something at the same time.
I have a lot of programmes that I like to watch and I never get a chance to actually turn on the TV the time that they're on. So I watch it online on demand whenever I want it.
If I heard about a show and someone's like, oh my God, you have to watch that, I'd go on to like the RT player, the Channel 4 player and watch it.
I can watch TV in my kitchen, or otherwise my parents are in the main sitting room with the big TV and the comfy chairs watching what they want to watch. So if I want to see any of the shows that I'm interested in, I kind of do need to watch it online on my laptop in my own time.
I don't have a Netflix account, but I've heard the Irish one is a bit limited in the selection, and I usually just go on to like streaming sites if I want to watch a film.
I don't actually have a Netflix account yet. I'm trying not to get one until I finish college, because I know once I get it, I'll be completely addicted to it and I'll probably watch full seasons of everything.
I'm generally a bit old school. I watch it on a television. I do watch some shows online, I might download something that's not on TV in Ireland.
Well, nice to know that's what old school constitutes now, watching television on the box. But while changing habits are interesting for TV broadcasters, the shift online and away from the TV schedule hits the bottom line, the revenue needed to make programmes. Laura Slattery, as a business media watcher, how is television changing?
Last year, we had quite a lot of developments. Netflix entered the market here with their on-demand service, which has quite a good price point, I think, at $6.99 a month. And UPC launched its on-demand service, which quite crucially meant that people could watch the RTE player and 3 player through their TV screens. So people who might have been reluctant to watch on a laptop were suddenly able to watch catch up in that way. And I think about half of the UPC views relate to those, you know, RTE and 3 player content and TG Cahir content, rather than the additional box sets and movies that they've added onto that service. In the meantime, Sky has developed quite a lot of new apps as well, which is encouraging people to watch what we would call non-linear television. So anything that basically doesn't go out live is classed as non-linear. The people who sell advertising in our broadcasters know that and are making quite good deals with companies to advertise in those mediums. The other thing about it is that because it's often younger people who access television content in this way, companies that want to target a younger market find that it's quite a good option for them.
So Laura, just explain how the Netflix model actually works.
Well, Netflix has a library of content that they've done deals with distributors in the US and elsewhere on their service, and you can access that content from quite a lot of different devices, and you can even watch it on your TV screen, perhaps through your Wii or your PlayStation or on your iPad. But the company has been around for a long time in the US. It started out as a postal DVD service, and in recent times now they have really helped drive their audience base by getting involved in original programming. Arrested Development, I think, was one of the first that was announced, because, you know, Arrested Development was a comedy show that ran between, I think, 2003, 2006. Some people felt it had been axed prematurely by the Fox network. And there was demand, you know, from that fan base for more episodes. So Netflix got involved with the showmakers and then they've brought it back, and those episodes are airing from, I think it's May 26th. But what happens is they all become available at once, I suppose. That's, so it's kind of mirroring the DVD box set marathon. And the same thing has happened with House of Cards, of course.
So Laura, you mentioned the fact that people are migrating online, that the audience is migrating online. That's what Pat Rabbit is targeting, isn't it, with his broadcasting charge? What's your assessment of that?
Yes. Now, most people who watch on-demand content do so in addition to content they watch on a traditional TV set. But there are some people who don't have a television set who use it as a substitute. And Pat Rabbit, he's probably, you know, right to be slightly alarmed, because if those trends continue, you're going to have a situation where nobody has a traditional TV set to which the television license has always been pegged. So I think it is going to be a difficult political sell for him. And if he can achieve that, that will be a big achievement for his time as Minister for Communications. Those changes haven't been made in the UK yet, for example.
So it's halfway through the minister's term, pretty much. Laura, how would you mark him out of 10?
I think the bigger problem for him, and it's, you know, something that I'm sure frustrates him, is the delay with the publication of the Consumer and Competition Bill. He wants the power to block and improve media mergers to be transferred from Minister Bruton's department to his, so he can become a de facto minister for media. And we've seen some delays in this, and we don't know when it's going to happen. So, you know, if that doesn't happen within the lifetime of his role as Minister for Communications, then I think that would be a big disappointment.
Laura Slattery of the Irish Times there, marking Minister Pat Rabbit's mid-term report card. The sound of TV3, California, Exposé and Tonight with Vincent Brown. Now, TV3 just opened a new high-tech studio in Ballymount and its new head of content, Jeff Ford, is with us now. Jeff, you wasted no time in putting down a marker to RTE and saying you are planning a new weekend chat show to rival The Late Late. Tell me more.
It was actually a sort of one of those statements that you say that actually got quite blown out of all proportion. The one thing that is probably one of the biggest things to ever talk about here is obviously The Late Late Show. So I think if anybody says, you know, all of a sudden you take that one point that was all about The Late Late Show and it became a headline on the front page of the Irish Daily Mail, which did please my wife and family, I must admit, being only here 6 weeks, to get that recognition.
Well, Jeff, you've said it was a throwaway comment, but since it's come up, how would you challenge The Late Late Show? It must be an ambition of yours.
People always say, well, how can you challenge it? I think that everything is challengeable. That's without a doubt. I would say, we can't go there. Because I think once you start putting barriers up, that's the wrong thing to do. So firstly, I think, we could have a look at it, certainly. I think you'd have to sort of say, what's it not doing now? I mean, I've read and spoken to a few people and they have told me sort of what it probably isn't doing that it used to do and that they miss it. The trouble is, I think may will be a bit of viewing habit people have got into by asking those are the sort of questions. That's how you find out what you try to create that may well be something that is like The Late Late Show, but actually isn't The Late Late Show, because you don't want to create another one. You want to create something that's different. Otherwise, what's the point?
How can you invest in new shows?
Where I've come from, I've always been quite used to being challenged in terms of budgets. So whenever I look at any programme, we're always trying to see, you know, where can we make this programme? Can we make it slightly different? How can we make the quality programme, but for slightly less money? So I've always been, that's how I've always looked at that particular challenge. I wouldn't have come here if I didn't think that I had a job to do to improve what the channel is all about, its standing, its brand. I think by having the studio gives us actually an opportunity that, because we own it, that cost is our cost, the cost has gone. We're not going out to someone else and actually saying, can we hire your studio and that's going to cost us X amount of euros. We've already got that facility. So I think in some respects we'll be able to sort of save money.
Now, you mentioned you're only here for the past 6 weeks, so you're new to Ireland, new to Irish society, new to Irish television. So what's your take on the Irish TV market from what you're seeing in terms of economy and choice? We are a very small country.
I think it's actually very good. I mean, in some respects, it's quite tough on us because there is the ability to get every single UK station as well as our stations. You know, there's an argument about how much money that some of those, you know, people like Sky, in terms of taking advertising out of our market and all that money going back to the UK. But I mean, which is a huge, huge issue for us.
Now, we have been talking about the impact of online and digital on television, and we've been hearing from young people under 25 who see television very much as content rather than as a platform. So they like certain shows and they find them wherever they are, through the players, through broadcast, through Netflix. How is that changing the way you think about television and the way you make television?
Television is not just for immediate consumption. What we do is when we purchase rights, we make sure that we have those catch-up rights for as many platforms as we can get or ones that are about to come up. So what we're trying to do is always have our brand attached to any programme that we produce. That also feeds down into that we need to ensure that we produce programmes, home-produced programmes, because those are the ones that we actually have pure ownership of. So therefore, we control how it's seen on various different platforms.
There is a challenge, I presume, though, to make online audiences as valuable as the old spot advertising broadcast model.
You know, although broadcast model is still working relatively well in terms of viewing numbers, not in terms of perhaps advertising revenue, but in terms of viewing figures, then, yeah, it'd be stupid of us to ignore that, of course. And so you have to see how can we enhance and how can we make that experience better and get more money out of that particular area of the market.
Now, what are the big winners for TV3 and how do you plan to build on them? And did I hear you're thinking of dropping California?
No, that was the headline from the Sunday Irish Daily Mail, where the headline was California to be axed, says TV boss. And then when you look two paragraphs down, it said, I have made no decision about California yet. I'm really proud of programmes like Temple Street, Rich Returns. We've got a show on now called The Estate. We launched a programme on Friday called The Big House, which is a big mountain production. And we had In the Name of the Republic. So, I mean, I think what we are is quite a broad channel, quite a broad channel. The ones I've mentioned are actually slightly, probably you'd say, slightly more, maybe higher end at market. And I think people forget, you know, they always say California, you know, and they forget. We actually offer quite a broad offering.
Now, you mentioned Vincent Brown there. He has been railing, as you know, against the new BAI Code on Fairness, Subjectivity and Impartiality, which was launched last week. He says it will limit his ability to present his programme.
I don't think anybody can limit Vincent how to present his programme, to be perfectly honest. Vincent is Vincent, and if Vincent changed, he would not be Vincent Brown. So I don't think we'll be changing anything with Vincent.
Jeff Ford there, TV3's new head of content, and we wish him all the best. I'm Brenda Power, and you've been listening to The Media Show. Next week, Irish Times chief executive Liam Kavanagh on paperless news, and the BBC's new boss, Tony Hall. Is he the man for the job?
He's a good man. They've got the right person, I believe, at the right time. Tony's BBC, I think, will be interesting.
You can share your media views with us on mediashow@rte.ie or join the conversation on Twitter using hashtag RTE Media Show. Talk to you next week.